WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherie Gross.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
It's been 30 years since that depressing advice was offered in the film The Graduate. An anniversary re-release is playing at the Film Forum in Manhattan and at the Castro in San Francisco, and will soon open in other cities around the country. We're going to hear about the making of The Graduate from the screenwriter Buck Henry, who adapted it from the novel of the same name. The Graduate was one of the first films to depict the alienation young people felt from their parents' generation in the 60s. And the audience was hungry for it. The Graduate had the biggest box office of the year and the second biggest of the decade. It was the film that made Dustin Hoffman a star. He played Benjamin Braddock, a college grad who's returned to his parents' upper-middle-class suburban home. He's lost. He has no idea what to do with his life, although he knows his future is not in plastics. One night after a party thrown by his parents in his honor, he's recruited to drive home Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft, convinces a reluctant Benjamin to come into the house. She puts on some mood music and gives him a drink.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Yeah, well, he guessed right, and she succeeds. But after they've started their affair, he falls in love with Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine, played by Catherine Ross. The mortified Mrs. Robinson tries to marry her daughter off to someone else, and she succeeds. But right after the I do's, Benjamin breaks into the church and runs off with Elaine. In the last scene, Benjamin and Elaine make their getaway on a bus. But after several moments of triumph and exhilaration, they're staring blankly into space. The screenwriter Buck Henry also co-wrote the TV spy spoof Get Smart, wrote the screenplays for Candy, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and has been a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. We spoke at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of The Graduate. Well, let's start with the end of the film. The end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph, and then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop, and this, like, uh-oh, what now expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, if things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole, it looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, I don't think we did test market it. But also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame. He's so odd-looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second-guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous, you've got to
No, nobody ever said that. And also, it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl, and they've run away from the people that they're scared of, and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
Did you know what was your guess?
No, I didn't know.
Because the movie's so open-ended, it leaves itself really open to a sequel, which you actually pitched in the movie The Player. And we actually have that scene here, the beginning of Robert Altman's movie The Player, set in Hollywood. And at the beginning of the movie, you know, throughout the movie, everybody's making their pitches to the big producer, played by Tim Robbins. Here's Buck Henry as himself in The Player.
Okay, here it is. The Graduate, Part 2.
Oh, good.
Now listen, the three principals are still with us. Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, Catherine Ross. Mm-hmm. 25 years later, and so are the characters. Ben, Elaine, and Mrs. Robinson. Ben and Elaine are married, still. They live in a big old spooky house up in Northern California somewhere. And Mrs. Robinson lives with them. Her aging mother, who's had a stroke.
Mrs. Robinson
has a stroke, so she can't talk.
It's going to be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
With
dark
a stroke?
And weird and funny and with a stroke.
Okay.
Maybe it's not a stroke. Maybe it's I don't know what
anyway,
it is.
Go on.
It's a malady of some sort.
Okay.
She's up there in the bedroom upstairs listening to everything that happens. They've got a daughter who's just graduated
that's
from
good,
college.
That's good. Young blood.
22, 23-year-old, like a
Julia Roberts.
Excuse
great.
Me.
Yes.
What did you let me do with these scripts?
That goes to Bonnie Chereau.
Okay.
And find out from studio security how Adam Simon got on the lot. I want to know.
Adam Simon? Okay.
Okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Julia Roberts
yes,
comes
Julia
home,
Roberts
their
comes
daughter,
home.
The graduate.
Yes,
and she's
the new graduate.
The new graduate.
The post-grad.
Okay, Griffin loved it. He just wanted me to run it by you.
Thank you.
So did you ever try pitching that one for real?
That was my real pitch. no, I thought it was, obviously I meant it to be a kind of parody of what people really do in studios. But that didn't stop after the opening night screening of The Player. It didn't stop a producer at a studio from stopping me in the outside of, by the popcorn and saying, you know, that was really amusing. But nevertheless, don't you think we can do something with that? It seems very practical somehow with the actors all being alive. I had to admit that's true. It is practical. It's hell to use dead actors. So It's been pitched a number of times over the years.
Did you pitch it to studios, or did they pitch it to you?
No, I've never. I think it's a totally crazy idea.
So you've turned down all requests.
Yeah.
What are some of the crazier pitches you've got?
For this?
Yeah.
They always say, you know, just carry on with the story, like
whatever that means.
Yeah, it's easy to do. So I thought we did about, I think it was 8 or 10 takes. Of The Player, and each time the pitch changed a little since it was all being improvised, and it got loonier and loonier. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel became characters at one point.
We'll continue our conversation with Buck Henry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview recorded at the Film Forum in Manhattan with Buck Henry, who wrote the screenplay for The Graduate, which has just been re-released. When the film came out in late 1967, it really tapped into something. There weren't really many films at all that were addressing this generational split, that were addressing the alienation that college people felt when they went home back to their parents' houses and they knew they didn't fit there anymore, and they didn't want to be there anymore, and their parents' friends were kind of scary to them. So this tapped into that at a time when Hollywood was always like several beats behind what was really happening in the world, and TV was even more beats behind that. What do you remember of what people were saying about what The Graduate meant, you know, to our culture when it was released? And what rang true to you, and what did you think was really, like, absurd?
Gee, that's a lot of questions in one. You know, it's odd because we didn't think of it as defining a time or a place and went about making it assiduously avoiding the errata of contemporary politics. And the only vague mention is when the guy who has the rooming house says, "Are you an outside agitator?" Which was more about Berkeley than it was about the time. And actually a critic, when the movie was released, took us to task for saying nothing about Vietnam, which I thought was really stupid, because it's simply not what it's about. It does come from a sensibility of some years before the time it was made, although I think the sensibility is universal. The sense of alienation that people have between teenagedom and 20-something years old, when they feel most hostile, a lot of people do, most hostile to their environment, to their parents, to their schools, to all that stuff. And since we all came out of the same time and the same sensibility, that is, Charles Webb, who wrote the book, Mike Nichols, Larry Terman, and I all got out of school, got out of college in the 50s, we all related to the same sources of that displeasure or enemy or whatever you want to call it.
To me, one of the greatest paradoxes of the movie is that it's about, you know, a young man who comes home and he's just so lost in his parents' environment. And so what does he do? He has an affair with his parents' mother. You know, it's the first film that really addresses the culture, you know, the generation gap. And so he's sleeping with somebody of the other generation. It's really paradoxical.
Always a good idea. pass the time and to get to know new friends.
I remember when I saw it when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me. Now,
well, they're
now,
two very different things, sleeping,
yeah,
you know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
Segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
So the movie was adapted from a 1963 novel. Whose idea was it to make it into a movie?
I think Larry Turman read the book and fell in love with it and brought it to Nichols. And they were then turned down by all five major studios. That I believe is the way it happened, which is how it ultimately came to Joe Levine. And it's odd when you think of it, because here's Nichols coming hot off Virginia Woolf. But I think they all thought it was too edgy and too racy and too questionable and didn't quite get what it was. There was no script. It was just the book. And then Mike said to me one day, read this and see what you think.
Now, you were the second or third screenwriter to have a go at it?
I was the third or fourth, as far as I know.
And all the previous adaptations were thrown out.
Right.
So what did they do wrong?
Well, I don't really know, because I didn't read them until after Calder Willingham sued for credit.
Sued you for co-credit?
Sued, yeah.
Sued you personally or sued the film company?
No, not sued. What's the word?
Arbitrated,
quite right, thank you. The other writers didn't. And I only read Willingham's script once, so I really don't know what he did wrong.
It's a diplomatic thing to say, too.
Now, well, I was surprised that he sued, because he's a really good writer, and he didn't need to.
Right, right. Now, tell me if I'm right about this. I don't know where I got this from, that the Charles Webb, the novelist, after the publication, went to live and work in a nudist colony. Did I make this up?
No, you didn't make it up, although you might have. It's even more complicated than that. Charles Webb, who is in a sense Benjamin Braddock, no surprise, he wrote the book, he wrote it out of his own experience, married this girl and sort of ran off from Eastern, I can't remember where he was brought up. It either was Pasadena or it wasn't. Whichever it was, they left it behind and they went on a kind of mystical journey where they've been for the last 30 years. I'm in constant contact with him. Although I haven't seen him in 30 years, I've spoken to him many times and we've corresponded. And about 10 years ago, he and his wife, who has changed her name to Fred, called me or wrote me from a nudist colony on the California coast somewhere and asked me if I would want to come down and be the best man or witness at their remarriage. And I'll probably always regret the fact that I turned it down, but I couldn't envision myself standing with a lot of naked people on the beach witnessing a marriage between Chuck and Fred. And they're wonderful, one might say somewhat eccentric people.
The most famous line in The Graduate is the line where one of the father's friends says, "I've just got one word for you, one word, plastics." That line struck a chord. I mean, it seemed to just kind of sum up everything that was false you know, that people didn't want their lives, their futures to be part of.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. It doesn't, you wonder why it took me more than 10 seconds, if indeed it did. I worried about plastics for a while and even talked to Mike about, are we too old-fashioned with plastics, which was sort of a 50s, 60s way of complaining about society's falseness. But I couldn't ever think of anything that was as interesting or more interesting, and or anything that wasn't a better word for them to say. Plastics is such a nice word. And the guy was so good who did it. The best thing about that was a few years later, I was watching television and I saw the scene come up, the party scene, except the actor didn't quite look like Dustin, and the actress sitting in the living room didn't quite look like Anne, but it was every shot all the way through plastics to the end of that piece, and then same photography, and then why not try the Peace Corps? And the Peace Corps had done an ad perfectly parodying the movie. I wish I had it. It was really a good piece of work.
Did you like it and respect it, or did you feel...
Oh, I thought it was terrific, yeah.
What year was this?
Beats me.
Back in the 60s, or...?
I think the 60s, yeah, I think, or maybe the early 70s.
Buck Henry, recorded at the Film Forum in Manhattan, which is now showing The Graduate. It's been re-released in honor of its 30th anniversary. It opens soon in other cities. We'll hear more from Buck Henry in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Buck Henry about the making of The Graduate. He wrote the screenplay. The film has been re-released to commemorate its 30th anniversary. I spoke with Buck Henry at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of The Graduate. You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. Ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
Wait, I understand you asked Doris Day, and...
I didn't ask anybody, God knows.
She was approached.
But I think... Larry and Mike asked Doris Day. I'm not sure. I think they did.
What about Ronald Reagan?
I don't know whether it ever got to him. And think how his life could have been made more meaningful.
That's right. Think how much different the country might have been.
There were a number of people. I know at one point Mike was thinking about Jeanne Moreau, which I think would have been wrong, although she would have been wonderful.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was... it's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. But it was so interesting. So then we rationalized it because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long. We had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller. And this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's wonderful.
And nobody ever... I mean, there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah. And
now the funny thing is, like I read, she was in her 30s, I think about 36 when making the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, although he's playing 20 years old, was really 29. So that would mean their ages are, what, 7 or 8 years apart, which, I mean, lots of people have relationships with people 7 or 8 years apart. It's... And
yeah, but you have to buy him as being 21.
As being younger, right. But did they have to do anything to make him look younger and her look older so that they'd seem far apart, even though they weren't really?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, Dustin... Well, you know, all male actors play younger than they are, inevitably. And I think Dustin is buyable as being 21. I was amazed when I found out he was 30. I had some experience of Dustin in the theater. He worked in a theater I was playing in the early 60s, and then in the mid-60s, I went to this performance of a Ronald Rabe play called Harry Noonan Knight, a really strange and interesting play in which Dustin played, in which I saw this guy, I didn't recognize him, playing one of the three lead parts. He was playing a crippled German transvestite. And I, by the middle of the first act, I knew I was seeing a really weird theatrical thing because I realized that the producer had gone out and hired a crippled German transvestite to play this part. The accent was perfect. The limp was spectacular. And his transvestitism was completely convincing. So I'd seen Dustin do really amazing, at least one amazing piece of work, but I didn't know until I saw him do the test that he could do this too.
Now, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot I listened to it a bit while working. He thought, well, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
Sounds of Silence. I think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and you know, there was never anything that could replace it. Finally, I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker. And you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called? The Strawberries?
The Lemonheads.
Lemonhead. Yeah. Well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
So what do you think of lines like cuckoo, ca-choo, Mrs. Robinson? Did you feel that enhanced the meaning you were trying to bring out?
I think Paul had a kind of off night when he did cuckoo to her. because he's generally very, very clever with lyrics, and I think maybe, I don't know.
I'm going to squeeze a little question into the couple of seconds we have remaining, which is, did you identify, aside from admiring some of your mother's friends, did you identify with the Benjamin Braddock character at all?
Totally.
With, you did?
Oh, yeah. Well, and so did Mike and so did Larry. We all did. I think that's what drove us toward, drove them toward the book and me subsequently, too.
What was it in your life when you were, say, in your 20s and out of college?
I was totally Ben Braddock. Uh-huh. I mean, when Mike and I started talking about this at the beginning, we were, you know, spent days laughing about our own ineffectual early 20s demeanor. You know, if we could, we'd sleep all day. If we, you know, we'd do anything to avoid any of the embarrassment of contacts with people we didn't know, family, all the sort of unspeakable acts that go on between members of the same generation. And also it's about, it's not only about not knowing really what you want to do or not having a passion to do something, but it's the fear of not being, of the passion not working out and the sort of stupidities you hear about other people, and then the other people are your own friends and family, and that's so appalling you don't know what to do with it. This isn't a universal attribute, thank God, but it does, it is something that happens in every generation with people of a certain age.
If you identified with Dustin Hoffman's character, that kind of adrift, I don't have a future, I don't know what my future is, what was the turning point for you? Were you found writing? You found theater and movies?
Well, I always knew I wanted to do it. It was just a question of people not letting me. So when I was younger, I got out of the Army and I spent years, like 7 or 8 years, sort of batting around. I'd go on tour with a show. I'd write things that nobody would buy. And I did all that stuff that actors do. And then finally I started working in television and it all became a clearer path. I was never, I'm very lucky. I've never been out of work since I started working. But the number of years before that were very edgy.
You excited to have the re-release of The Graduate? Is that something you're pleased about?
Oh, I think it's swell. I hope people enjoy it. I hope it doesn't seem like we're battering them with it since something happened 5 years ago with it. And I mean, maybe it's a perennial. But it's... I think it's pretty good, and so it's okay that it's there.
Buck Henry, thank you so much for coming. It's wonderful
Thanks.
For you to be here.
Thank you, Terry.
Buck Henry wrote the screenplay for The Graduate. We spoke at the Film Forum in Manhattan after a screening of the film. It's been re-released in honor of its 30th anniversary.